Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Luis Gev and Ira Harris. Luis co-founded GaveCal in 1999 with his father Charles and Anatolia Kaletsky. Since 2005, he's mostly focused on the money management side of the business. Before co-founding GaveCal, Luis worked for Paribas Capital Markets, where he was an equity research analyst from 1997 to 1999. He studied economics, history, and Chinese at Duke University and Nanjing University. In the past decade, Luis has written 5 books, including 2 different for Comfort. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks, Richard. This is great. Blog last year's podcast in May that we did, people keep coming back and go, I followed it. I had a great 6 months. See what you can do. Sometimes you get it right, but we'll see. Yeah.
Great.
I really enjoyed our conversation 6 months ago, so I'm glad to be back.
Yep. Excellent. And you've written a piece recently on the 10 most important changes of the last year. Before we get into that, just wondering your thoughts, Luis, on the current state of the economy, the challenges, and the financial markets outlook for this coming year.
Well, that's a broad question. I think the first and most important acknowledgement that we all have to make is that when you look at any economy, you have 3 very important prices that almost drive all the others. These prices are the U.S. dollar, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, and the price of oil. You get the direction of these 3 prices right, and you're going to broadly, do okay. The pieces will fall into place. Now, I believe that when we spoke last May, the U.S. dollar was rising and above its 200-day moving average. U.S. Treasury yields were falling and below their 200-day moving average. And oil prices were falling and below their 200-day moving average. Fast forward to today, so 6-7 months later, and all of this has been turned on its head. Instead of being in an environment of falling yields, we are now in an environment of rising yields. Instead of being in an environment of rising U.S. dollar, we are now in an environment of falling U.S. dollar. Instead of being in an environment of falling oil and falling commodities, we are now in an environment of rising oil and rising commodities. So the investment environment has changed dramatically in the past 6 months. Now, we can go into the reasons as to why that is. We can discuss how sustainable that is. I tend to believe it is sustainable. I tend to believe that, once these trends get put in place, they tend to last for a while. So if, like me, you believe that we've entered a U.S. dollar bear market, that we've entered a bond bear market, and we've entered a commodity bull market, then I think this should have big implications for your portfolio. Now, if you look at your portfolio and you still have the same portfolio that you had 6 months ago when all these trends were the opposite, then you may want to revisit that because obviously you haven't adjusted to the new underlying realities.
And your thoughts, Ira?
100%. And, I go back to the piece because, Richard, Lewis doesn't, I mean, most of my work begins with the currency and bond markets. And then as I follow the ripples effects of that, I find my way to all types of possible investments. And I know we're not into it yet. Lewis's piece on the 10 that I think it was December 16th. There's a line in there that I keep coming back to because he says, one day central banks will decide that they need to support their currencies instead of supporting their bond markets. In this scenario, bond markets will implode. In short, following the massive intervention of central banks, governments, bonds all across the Western world will now become return-free risks. So I think it's, you know, it's such an important couple sentences to sum up where we've gotten in. And I think Louis is absolutely right. When we met last mid-May, the dollar was rising. And then an event happened, I think, the week after we talked, which I cited in my blog. I think the euro was trading down around 107, 108. It was Memorial Day in the U.S. That weekend. And I thought something significant took place in Europe, which was that Wolfgang Schäuble did his famous pivot where he went from Mr. Nine and fiscal austerity to saying that they needed to do a common euro bond to fund those nations who were really struggling because of COVID. And he said just giving loans would be very disruptive. In fact, he had a great line. Adam Tooze, who's one of my favorite political economists, picked up on, and it was easy to see where Schäuble made the comment, if you give them loans, it's like giving them more rocks in their pockets, whereas if you give them grants, you're giving them bread. And I thought that was a very telltale sign because for the first time we were going to get an actual euro bond, which we did, $750 billion. Now, in the face of things, that's not a great thing by its numbers, but it was an important, I think, pivot, which said there's now an alternative to the dollar because, you know, everybody goes, the dollar's a haven. Well, and I think in the interview with Louis, somebody did a couple days ago or said, I mean, time is lost. But the important thing with the dollar is that right now, when it transfers from being a store of value to only a means of exchange, which I think is going on, then the dollar struggles. But that means all the other currencies rally and what those central banks have to do in response to it in these most difficult times then becomes a critical part of the trading platform.
So, Ira, I think you mentioned something very, very important there that I'd like to pick up on if I could. And basically, you alluded to the question of yield curve control by the Fed. And, you know, that's obviously today's buzzword, but, the general idea that if interest rates go up too much, the Fed will step in to prevent the rise in interest rates and thus, basically prevent losses from being taken on bonds. Now, of course, nothing is free. And, you know, if this is, you know, what the ECB did back in 2013 to prevent the European crisis from blowing up the euro, and when the ECB decided to go down that path, of course the euro went from 145 down to 105. The question is, you know, are we reaching that point? Will we reach that point in the US? Is a question I often get from clients, and you know, I'm starting to wonder whether we actually haven't reached that point already in the U.S. Let me explain. If you look at the monthly increase in the Fed balance sheet, so, you know, the Fed publishes its balance sheet every week, and you can look at the monthly increase. The increase for December for the Fed was $160 billion U.S. dollars, a billion with a B, like Boris. This represented the eighth highest monthly increase in the Fed balance sheet on record. In December, we had the eighth largest increase in the Fed balance sheet. Now, the top three increases in the Fed balance sheet came in March, April, May of this year, you know, when, you know, with the COVID shutdowns, the economy was imploding, markets were imploding. So the Fed intervened like never before. The next three came in October, November, December of 2008, after Lehman went bust. The seventh came in March 2009, which was also in the wake of Lehman and was basically the bottom of the S&P 500. These were the seven biggest increases in the monthly Fed balance sheet. And they all occurred in the midst of massive crises, right? You know, COVID crisis, Lehman crisis. The Fed had to step in from the markets becoming dislocated, in essence. The eighth just occurred in December at a time when the frothy activity on U.S. financial markets could hardly be higher. If you look at the valuation of the S&P 500, you're basically at the top 10th percentile in terms of valuation. You've had so many examples of frothy activity out there, whether the surge in the SPACs, Tesla moving from being a $50 billion stock to a $700 billion stock in the space of a few months. All this stuff actually that's gone on in the electronic car. If you're looking for signs of froth, it's there. This is usually when you had this much froth back in 99 and when valuations were stretched as they are in 99, the Fed was taking away the punch bowl, right, to use the proverbial saying. In December of this year, the Fed decided to spike the punch bowl to add $160 billion in a situation where arguably, things are frothy already. So why would they do this? Is it A, that, the Fed has just become nuts and they've just lost all sense of perspective, option one, or option B, yield started to rise and the Fed started to worry that the rise in yield would derail the U.S. economy, would rise the funding costs for the U.S. government, so on and so forth. I'm going to go with B. I'm going to go with the latter. Not that the Fed has gone nuts, but that in essence, the Fed is already embracing yield curve control. Which goes back to something we were talking about, before we started recording. When you look at global interest rates today, the big question is, did interest rates fall or were they pushed? Now, when you look at the fact that we have unprecedented negative real rates around the world, that at a time when growth is reaccelerating and inflation is reaccelerating and and the frothiness on financial markets is at all-time highs. The fact that the Fed comes in and, in essence, empties a whole bottle of Everclear into the punch bowl at this very moment in time, to me, is a clear indication that interest rates were pushed. They did not fall. They were pushed. And therefore, we now live in a world where you have central banks that are clearly in the business of keeping interest rates down and proceeding to what Keynes called the euthanasia of the rentier. And these central banks are mostly in the Western world. And then you have central banks that want to maintain real rates. And those are mostly in emerging markets. And so if you're looking for protection of your capital, if you're the rentier, what you can be guaranteed of is that the Western central banks are trying to kill you. So if you're the rentier, you have to be nuts to keep money in government bonds or in cash in Western countries, because the central banks are openly trying to destroy the value of that currency. So your first question as an investor should be, given that the central banks are actively trying to destroy the value of my currency, what do I do about it? Do I go to gold? That's one option. Do I go to commodities? That's another. Do I try to find dividend yielding stocks? That's a third. Or do I go into foreign currencies where the central bank isn't going to destroy the value of my currency? And at the risk of being somewhat long-winded, I would say I'd go back to something else you said, Ira, which is that, the U.S. dollar was a savings currency. Well, that actually corresponds to the framework we use at Yafcal, which is that if you look at the world, you really have three major types of currencies. You have your commodity currencies, the Canadian peso, the Brazilian real, the South African rand, the Norwegian krone, the Australian dollar, etc. So you have your commodity currencies. You have your what we call the trading currencies, the currencies of the countries that basically thrive by having typically an undervalued exchange rate and a large current account surplus. So your China's, your Korea's, your Mexico's, and the like. And then you have your saving currencies, the US dollar, the euro, the Swiss franc, the yen, the sterling, the currencies that, you know, if you're Malaysian or if you're South African or if you're Brazilian and you don't trust your own government, typically you own one of these. Well, today, when you look at the savings currencies, all of them are being actively destroyed by their central banks. So if so the savings currencies are no longer providing the function that they've done for the past 30 or 40 years. So the money, I think, will flow out of the savings currencies and into the trading currencies, into the commodity currencies. Those are the currencies that you need to be exposed to today.
And one of those most important changes of last year, you mentioned as a change in renminbi policy for China's currency. Can you elaborate on that in relation to what you just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So look, I first moved to China in 94. I've had the chance to have a front row seat, to the world's biggest economic transformation. Having said that, through all this time, there was always, almost one constant. And the constant was that whenever, and you know, the renminbi started to get depegged to the US dollar and, appreciate, against the US dollar back in 2005. And through this whole time, the one constant of Chinese policymakers was that if and when you had something bad happen, i.e., obviously the SARS crisis of 2003, but after that, the mortgage crisis of 2008, after that, the Chinese equity market boom and bust of 2015, the initial reaction of Chinese policymakers is, let's freeze the currency. And you saw this time and again. You know, following the 2008 crisis, the renminbi flatlined for almost 2 years. The view was, ooh, things are dicey. Let's not take any risks. Let's freeze the currency, see how things settle, and then, you know, we'll make a decision on the other side of this crisis. And so crisis after crisis, it was a constant of Chinese policy to, you have a crisis, you freeze the currency. Here, obviously, you know, we have the COVID crisis around the world. It's the biggest economic shock on record. You know, if you'd asked me at the beginning of the COVID crisis how Chinese policymakers would respond to this vis-a-vis their currency, I would say, well, you know, if history is your guide, they're going to freeze it. And the renminbi will now be flat for the next 6 months or 12 months or even 2 years. But lo and behold, the renminbi's had its biggest six months gain on record. You know, you've just witnessed the biggest appreciation in the renminbi over a 6 month period. It's basically outperformed every single currency out there. And so this is a very clear sign that there is now a different renminbi policy in China. You know, they are no longer intervening in the market as much as they used to in the past to freeze the currency. Now you could say, well, it's because the numbers are getting too big. They just can't intervene the way they used to, because there's two things going on right now. The first is that China is running record trade surpluses of roughly $75 billion a month. So that's $75 billion that's coming into your economy, number one. And number two, you're seeing record inflows into the Chinese bond markets by foreigners for the simple reason that China is the only place in the world that, major bond market in the world that still offers investors positive real rates. There's obviously other emerging markets that do that, but it's the only major bond market in the world that offers investors positive real rates. And so, you know, if you're a foreign investor, it's also, by the way, the only bond market in the world that is out. So Chinese bond market started to open to foreigners in 2012. Since then, it's the only major bond market in the world that has outperformed U.S. treasuries. Now, if you look at the renminbi is now the strongest currency in the world on a 10-year basis, on a 3-year basis, on a 12-month basis. So any sort of meaningful time frame, the renminbi is now the world's strongest currency. And, you know, if like me, you tend to believe that capital will flow to where it is best treated, a little bit like water flows downhill, then we shouldn't be surprised that money is now flowing into the renminbi. That's where it is being rewarded. And so the capital flows are such that, yes, the renminbi is moving up. And, you know, if the Chinese government wants to stem that, they would have to intervene to such an extent in the financial markets. They would have to print so much renminbi that they would probably risk triggering too high a domestic inflation, or at least higher than they feel comfortable with.
Your thoughts, Ira?
This is the most important ground I think anybody who listens to this podcast will get. Because, again, how is capital treated? And, you know, this static view of Wall Street, and it is a static view, is, you know, haven, dollars a haven. You know, Richard, on this, with your podcast, you know, I tackled a lot of ground with people, you know, who said, oh, you know, it would be a haven. People were bullish, you know, and I said, no, after the Wolfgang Schreiber and after our podcast last May was when I turned definitively, and I did a lot in these podcasts. This is very important, the way money is treated. So where Lewis goes now, when in that interview, he talked about where, and I'm glad he went right to the yield curve control, because I think this is a significant part of the first story of the six months, maybe all of 2021, because it's political as well as economic, which is, of course, where I think GavCal certainly thrives and has been my expertise for as long as I've been in this business. What is going to be the politics of this? And so Lewis makes a point how much they bought in December, which is an extraordinary amount, let alone that it's in December and things are slowing down as we know, but they're building up that balance sheet. And we have a new regime in town with a new Secretary of Treasury, but a well-known individual, of course, when it comes to money, because it's Janet Yellen. And I certainly respect Yellen as a person and as an economist, a labor economist. I thought that her role in the Fed was not a good one, because she really took the Fed down the path of pushing it further with the Fed Listens programs in generating a sense of a social justice mandate. And I think that's I love that she can do that as the Secretary of Treasury. I don't like that the Fed chair goes down that road. I have this severe criticism of Powell, because when he went down the road of, well, you know, we have to protect all the people who've lost their jobs through no fault of their own, that it really set a course for the Fed that was a dangerous course. And I think really perpetuates them accumulating more and more assets. To what avail? You know, it's one thing to QE1. I think that was the most necessary program, whether there was fiscal stimulus or not, because you wanted to prevent the type of Andrew Mellon scenario of liquidate, liquidate, liquidate. It's where I broke with the Tea Party. You could not go down that road of just liquidating assets to punish borrowers. The political fallout would have been immense. So now they're going to try to protect against this. And I think in Lewis's interview, he said 2% on the 10-year. I think he just, not that that was a hard number, it was a number for discussion, in which one of my most enlightened blog readers, Mike Temple, sent me an email going, he said, I think about 1.5%, and he's a big fan of Lewis. I said, I think you're high. I say 1.25, especially if I view. See, I think Powell's going to resign. I know it's hanging out there, but if I was Jerome Powell, why would I want to stay in this mess? There is nothing good coming down the pike, and you may as well go grab all the money that's going to be thrown at you for speaking engagements. He's 67 years old, and turn the reins over to Leo Brainard, who has been the at the vanguard of the Fed's musings on yield curve control, because I think with what Yellen is going to be pushing at, they're going to need yield curve control. They cannot or do not want yields rising on the long end, which, by the way, is not a until yield curve control, it is more market oriented, as we've seen for the last couple of days with the action and reactions with the U.S. 30-year. I'm sitting right now, I'm looking at the 210 level on the U.S. curve this morning. It's out to 93. Well, it's a very substantial move from where it was laying for quite a long time, between 60 and 63 basis points. So we've had almost 50% rise in the curve itself, and the 530 has even been more dynamic. And which is interesting from a trader's standpoint is, as these curves steepen, two things happen. Of course, bank stocks have gone wild. I'm looking right now, JP Morgan's up $6 today after being up a sizable amount, Goldman Sachs. So the algorithmic models are so pegged, yield curves are steepening, banks are going to make more money no matter, regardless of how low interest rates, because nothing's going on the short end, of course, and that's where the Fed has much more direct control until they get into yield curve. So, but with that, what had happened? The gold got hit pretty hard in the last day and a half because of the 30-year yield. So the algos are written to the 30-year, which I find fascinating because that's not over 40 years. That's not the way that I see the work. In fact, the equity markets are performing much better because when yield curves steepen, for the first 6 to 8 months of that steepening, equity markets actually rally. That's the history of my work. And then when the Fed responds in its traditional manner, they start raising short-term rates because they go, oh, we're behind the curve. That's what the market action is telling us. And then the equity markets start to sell off and the dollar starts to rally. But here, I know, because you like this morning, as we talked earlier, the Japanese are out talking about, they're concerned about the currency. Well, you know what? None of them can talk about this, especially after what the Treasury just came out. And unfortunately, well, Switzerland is a case, and Lewis and I could probably do a 2-hour podcast on what the SNB is doing and its implications for the global financial system going forward and what lessons are being learned. And it was a total shame that they named Vietnam, because as I noted in my blog, they should be carpet bombing Vietnam with kindness, not as they're trying to escape from all the ravages of the wars and things that have destroyed them for the last 40, 50 years. Why would you want to do that, especially when you're trying to change the supply chains from out of China? And Vietnam has certainly taken advantage of it. So I didn't understand that whatsoever. But countries have to be very careful here, the way they respond, because if the U.S. is trying to drive its currency lower, and I think that they're, of course, I'll never say it, but as Lewis says, that if you stop treating your currency, especially when you're the world's reserve currency, in a fiduciary responsibility and only using it as a means of exchange and not a store of value, you have some serious problems confronting you, and these have to be dealt with. But the most importantly, now you have Yellen, who understands this role very well at the Treasury, and you have even Powell, who has really become the Minister of Social Justice. But if he were to give way to Lael Brainard, I think that would send a phenomenal signal. We'd get the next leg up in all the asset classes that Lewis mentioned. But I'm waiting to see how this plays out and where the Fed is going to become more aggressive. Because politically, as Yellen knows, you cannot let the long end of the curve go up too high, because the cost of financing, you can't do it all anymore in the T-bill market. The T-bill market has really struggled because Mnuchin et al. Have done so much on the short end as far as borrowings and other things. And, of course, the Treasury General Account, which is overly bloated. There's things that work on the short end. So if you let long yields, and I think this is Lewis's point, take the brunt of it, the cost of borrowing for the U.S. government is going to soar, and all those discretionary spendings are going to come under sharp review, or you will just totally capitulate to MMT. So I'm going to leave that right there, because I know that Lewis is going to respond to the MMT.
Absolutely. I love the magic money tree. So look, I'll start off with making one point that I should have made in the piece that you refer to, and that is that, you know, as money managers, I always tell this to my clients. I believe I'm paid to adapt, not to forecast. You know, the world is hard enough to understand as it evolves. It's you know, projecting yourself forward is even more challenging. And as you point out in that piece, I sort of make a forecast and saying, look, I think that they'll start doing yield curve control when we reach 2%. And turns out that, you know, when I said that, this was mid-December, I didn't have the data from the Fed activity in December. I got that in early January. And, I now know that actually the yield curve control didn't start at 2%, started at 90 basis points. You know, when I look at that $160 billion increase in the Fed balance sheet, for me, that is the yield curve control. Now, to your point, Ira, they haven't come out and said it, and you know, maybe you need a catalyst event for them to, for the market to realize, hold on, this is what's going on here. But I think we're here already. So my 2%, to your point, Ari, saying, oh, I think it's going to be at 125. I actually now think it's already happening. In mid December, I thought it'll happen in a while, and it turns out to have happened sooner than I anticipated. So we are now here. And now, you know, you mentioned two asset classes that I believe I mentioned in that piece. One of them was gold, the other is financial. The reality is, I think we're now in the exact quandary that I described in this piece, which is either the yield curve is allowed to steepen, in which case financials will massively outperform. And as you point out, this is what the market is today pricing in, or not pricing in, but starting to react to, because, you know, to a large extent, banks everywhere are still very cheap. So that is what the market is starting to react to. And then once it becomes very obvious to the market that the Fed has actually embraced yield curve control, that interest rates won't be allowed to go up for a very long time, if ever. I don't know what it's going to take for the market to acknowledge this this shift of policy from the Fed. To your point, Ira, maybe it is a change in at the head. You know, who knows. But, you know, once I think that happens, then I think you have the massive rotation where the U.S. dollar takes another 15 to 20% down leg, and, you know, potentially gold indeed rallies very hard. So you could almost think that, okay, given the fiscal policy today of the United States, which is to run many trillion dollar deficits, and to do so for as far as the eye can see. Given the fiscal policy and the monetary policy to have these deficits in essence funded by the magic money tree, given this policy mix, you need to have two tail risk hedges in your portfolio. The first tail risk hedge is financials in case interest rates at the long end do shoot up, option one. And the other is some kind of hedge on the U.S. dollar collapsing. And yes, that might be gold, that might be renminbi bonds, that might be Canadian dollars. There's various options. And, you know, given the inherent volatility of each of these various options, you may want to make a basket of them. But you in essence need those two tail hedge risks to keep sleeping at night. And that brings me to another point that I think you also alluded to in your remarks, Ira, which is, you know, about the U.S. dollar being the traditional safe haven, and U.S. treasuries, for that matter, being the ultimate safe haven in our system. I would go one step further. I don't know if you read Nassim Taleb's or Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile. But to me, this was actually what I think of one of the more important books I read in finance in the past. I don't know. I think he came out with it 5 or 6 years ago. You know, Taleb's notion in Anti-Fragile is you know, a fairly intuitive one, but it was great to see it written black and white, that you actually have things that profit from disorder, that benefit from disorder. It might be individuals that, you know, rise to a challenge in a way that when others crumble. It might be, you know, things in nature that thrive, in periods of chaos and disorder. And it's of course also true in financial markets. Now, the ultimate anti-fragile asset for, you know, my entire career, I know you're older than me, Ara, but pretty much your entire career as well, has been U.S. Treasuries. U.S. Treasuries were terrific because they were giving you strong absolute returns, in the same way, but in, with a negative correlation with equities. And the way I've put it in a number of papers is that, if you think of the role of a portfolio manager as you would, a coach of a football team, then your U.S. Treasuries, in essence, were your offensive line. You know, they're the building block on which you could build the rest of your team. You put your offensive line out there and you expect your offensive line to protect your quarterback, to give running space to your running back. It's a, you know, extremely important part of your team. And that's what U.S. Treasuries were for 40 years. They were the offensive line in your portfolio. Well, the bad news for you, if you're the coach of that team, is that all your offensive linemen, left for the summer and they all went on a massive diet. And now instead of weighing 350 pounds, they weigh 150 pounds. And so they come back from the summer weighing 150 pounds, which means that, you know, in portfolio terms, that's the real rates on U.S. Treasuries moving from +1.5 to -2%. That's the offensive lineman of 150 pounds. And if you're the coach of that football team, what use do you have for offensive linemen of 150 pounds? The bonds no longer can do the job that you expect them to do for your portfolios. And we've seen this through 2020. In March, when the market started to fall apart, I tend to believe that the reason the Fed intervened in the market wasn't that U.S. equities were falling apart. It was much more that the U.S. Treasury market broke down. And I think we spoke about that last May. The U.S. Treasury market broke down and that forced the Fed's hand. And so you are now at a critical juncture where if U.S. Treasuries can no longer be counted to be your offensive lineman, you still need an offensive lineman. You still need to protect your quarterback. And to be honest, the only place you can find 350-pound offensive linemen today is in emerging markets, and most notably in China. So you are starting to see that capital flow out of the Western bond markets and flow into the Chinese bond markets and other emerging markets. And for me, that will be a key trend of 2021. And I don't see, I think to be honest, you can't own enough emerging market bonds today. And again, Chinese bonds, for me, that's the extremely, extremely obvious development. And I know I'm long-winded. I'll end up with one more thing. You know, I've done emerging markets my whole life. I've lived in Hong Kong for my entire professional career for all intents and purposes. And one of the things you learn pretty quickly when you do emerging markets is that when you see the combination of a rising bond yields and falling currency, it's usually not a good combination. You know, if I'm invested in Indonesia and I see rising bond yields and a falling currency, then I think, you know, can only conclude one thing, and that is that you're seeing capital flight, that foreigners are deciding or locals are deciding, I don't want to be in Indonesia anymore. And if the crowd decides, I don't want to be in Indonesia anymore, unless I have a very strong reason to be there, then I tend to leave as well. You know, the combination of rising yields, falling currency. With rising yields, you should have rising currency. Well, look at the U.S. We've just had a big rise in yield. We've gone from 50 basis points to 109 today. And with that, the U.S. dollar has been falling out of bed. this is what a sick emerging market does. And that's before I go into political riots, into contested elections, into, frankly, the inability to run an election that everybody trusts in, which is a sort of staple of emerging markets, or at least used to be a staple of emerging markets. So I look at all this, and, you know, I think the capital flight out of the U.S. is just starting. And, you know, foreign investors are about as overweight the U.S. as they have historically ever been. And because it has worked tremendously well for the past 10 years, the reality is it's no longer working. They're down on U.S. treasuries. They're down on the U.S. dollar. And even if U.S. equities are now going up, they're not going up enough to compensate for the losses on the U.S. dollar. If you look at the S&P 500 today, in spite of the $4.5 trillion that the Fed has injected, the S&P 500 adjusted for the fall in the U.S. dollar is roughly at the same levels as it was in February 2020. So, you know, if you're a Canadian investor and you own the S&P 500, if you're a French investor and you own the S&P 500, if you're a Korean investor and you own the S&P 500 or a Chinese investor, what you've made on your U.S. equities, you've lost on the currency. So you're running fast to stand still. And so we're now entering a phase of the cycle where the Fed prints money to keep asset prices up, but it keeps asset prices up, but it's actually an illusion because the U.S. dollar on the other side is taking away all the value that you make on the U.S. On the assets.
That's a very interesting point. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, first of all, Lewis, being a high school quarterback, I understand your that metaphor of the offensive line 100%. You know, I love those guys. They're still my friends. We get hugs, and I'm going back a long time. But I was sitting here chuckling about it because that's exactly running backs are only as good as those. So they are what we would call the blue collar workers. They get
you know what are the just like a portfolio manager for the past 40 years has learned to really love his bonds, really love his U.S. treasuries. How many times has your typical, you know, wealth manager, portfolio manager, et cetera, has had his bacon saved by an allocation to U.S. treasuries? They love their U.S. treasuries just as much as you loved your offensive linemen.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the thing is, Lewis, let me take it away. The only time you notice an offensive lineman is when he's caught for a penalty.
Yeah, when he messes up. That's right.
Right? Yeah. So yeah. The metaphor continues so beautifully because right now there's a mistake. Well, we're seeing it. But this is so, I think, you know, so right on target. And I found it interesting, Lewis, that you moved to China in 1994 because this is a very important thing. And I think this is why Gav Cal's work, and amongst a few others, I think Bookware, others, Jim Grant, what separates them from Wall Street? Wall Street is built on static analysis, as far as I'm concerned. What worked in the past will they bring forward to the future. That's what all the algorithms are built on anyway, as you watch them and the way they respond. And I loved 2020, as I kept telling all my readers, and when I would go to other rooms to talk, White Wave, Richard, and of course with Matt Kenna, these rooms, and I said, what we're starting to see slowly, and this is what Lewis talks about, is the breakdown of these correlations that have been powered by the algorithms with their machine-driven ability to mathematically create these correlations and see them and react to them in a very powerful way. So they're starting to break down, and to exactly what Lewis talks about. So you want somebody, and this is what Gav Cal does so very well, who responds, not just sits there and goes, well, I'm just going to do more of what, because no, that's not what's working. And that's not what's going to take place. And when Lewis put out some of, you know, we talked about stocks and Lewis had a checklist. I said, oh, I like Freeport. Oh yeah, we own that. I like Glencore. And they've done very well, but they were so unloved. Nobody wanted them. Now, of course, you see them pushing them. Yesterday, the classic case is that yield curve steepened. Then they came buying in big. They bought Bunge. They bought Archer Daniel. The bank stocks are piling into. So everything we talked about in May, is absolutely, it's already moved dramatically. I actually sold out my Freeport yesterday and moved into others because that was the last of my Freeport, but it's been a great play. And I don't know, you know, I get a little nervous when especially companies like that do so phenomenally well. Yes, I know when we talked about them, they were so unloved, but you want that dynamic analysis and more importantly, reactions. Those to be dynamic. It's like, you know, I always compare it to a battlefield. You can develop a plan for what's going to take place, but everything shifts. As you know, Mike Tyson famously says, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. I want to be the people who know how to respond to getting punched in the face. I don't want them, well, I've taken that punch before, give me another. No, it's not. And I think Wall Street struggles at a lot of static views. Like they're looking at now the banks. Well, the curves are steepening. I'm buying banks. Well, somebody's buying a lot of them up here. Meanwhile, Citi still can't take out the high, you know, where it closed in December of 2019. JP Morgan's up to that level. Of course, Goldman, because they're much more of a hedge fund in so many of the ways that they react, is outperforming them all. But again, be dynamic. And when Lewis talks about moving to China, 1994, that's dynamic. Why? Because two things happened on January 1st, 1994. Of course, he had the commencement of NATO of NAFTA, the commencements of NAFTA, and the Chinese devalued the renminbi 50% from 5.8 to 8.7 because they saw what was coming and what the purpose of NAFTA was. And, of course, they stole the thunder from the Asian tigers that began. And then by July 2nd, 1997, when you get the Thai baht in crisis, all the impact from China stealing the thunder of the Asian tigers led to the great crisis of 97-98. Because we had the onslaught of China into the world. So I applaud. It tells you what vision they had. And it's that vision, but not only having the vision, but being able to react to it. And I think this discussion about the dollar and the bond markets is very critical. And as Dave Richards, who I believe he either resides in Hong Kong or Singapore, writes into the blog, and him and I had the discussion, because I talked about 46 to 51 with what took place in the United States. And there are a lot of people who will pick up from that. But that's only a way to look at it. I would not, the United States is nowhere near at that same period of time. And if you think that it is, and you think that you can model that for what's going to take place now, I think that's a fool's errand. 46 to 51, the United States was in total control of the world situation. And the only thing that they had to do was put in George Kennan and, the whole policy of containment, because all they would do was want to contain the Soviet Union. And we know how that came about was not a good thing. So I, you know, I will finish my conversation here that we're in a very interesting year because, you know, Lewis talks about the dollar and the role of the dollar. And I certainly grew up in that. You know, my commencement into trading was really after the fall of Bretton Woods, which was necessitated by, we can use him because Giscard d'Estaing, who just died, who with Jacques Rouff, his lead economist in the Monetary Sin of the West, and they talk, and that was the exorbitant privilege of the dollar. But now, over the last years, as Michael Pettis, who I have great respect for, has talked about the exorbitant burden of the dollar. Well, this is what's going to start to unravel, the exorbitant burden of the dollar, and what is it going to take? Now, there's a lot of countries out there, like Japan this morning, okay, who they don't like the dollar going lower. They don't like the dollar going lower. And there's not supposed to be any type of currency manipulation. But, you know, let's end that game and that nonsense. And I don't care how many G7 meetings you have. And G20s that tell us, oh, there's no, you know, we're opposed to currency manipulation. Manipulation is a big word, so we'll find other ways. But everybody's trying to keep their currency low. But I got news for you. Not everybody can keep their currency low. Is Bitcoin a statement about that? I don't know. That's a whole other discussion. But I do think that Bitcoin is really getting a charge because of my favorite people, and I'm sure Lou's, who the global titans, the titans of global macro, I should say, the Tudors, the Druckenmiller, Kovner. We can go on and on. I think they've gotten into this because they're tired of being run around by the algos and, of course, the central banks, and they can play in an arena where they can push like they used to in the 80s and 90s when they get some momentum and really push this. So I think that's going on. I'm remiss in missing that because I love the blockchain end of it. I just was fearful of the cryptocurrency because I always believed that governments hate competition. And governments, one of their greatest purview is, of course, their ability to control their currency, at least to a certain point, until they can't control it anymore. Watching yesterday's scenes out of the U.S., which were just shook you to the ground. You know, I've had a continual thought that I thought the 20s in the U.S. were going to look like Weimar. Unfortunately, for many different aspects, and people, I tongue in cheek, I say to people, they say, how would you invest? I said, I'm buying cabarets, you know, I see Weimar, and that's a sad statement about what a great country this is, but, that's where I'm leaving, but it leaves us with a lot of dynamic perspectives about going forward.
Just coming up to a time constraint here. Your final thoughts, Lewis, on?
Well, my final thoughts is, I think as investors, we have to acknowledge that we are in a deeply transformational period. Again, a lot of the key prices in our economies are starting to shift under our very feet. And we also, I think this is, of course, a direct consequence of the unprecedented policy paths that we've taken in the past year, whether, you know, deciding to lock down most of the Western world's populations, stop economic activity in its tracks by diktat. Number one, compensate that by unprecedented money printing, compensate that by unprecedented fiscal expansion that, you know, usually when you see the kind of fiscal expansion we just witnessed, you've seen it in some places in the past, like China, for example. But in the past, you know, it usually goes, or in the U.S. post-World War II or during the Great Depression, usually it goes to fund infrastructure spending. You go and you fund the building of new roads and airports and canals and, you know, power plants and whatever else that, you know, on the other side, you hope will give you enough productivity to pay back the borrowing you just took. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But when we look at the U.S. today or the most Western countries, the increase in borrowing has basically funded directly people to stay at home and watch TV. For the $4.5 trillion increase in debt over the past 12 months in the U.S., how many new roads did you get? How many new airports? How many new canals or power plants or railways? The answer is zero. There has been zero increase in infrastructure spending in the U.S. 12 months ago or 18 months ago, there was a big debate as to whether Congress should do a $1 trillion infrastructure spending plan that, you know, I think, frankly, as somebody who travels in the U.S. fairly often, the U.S. could use. You could use an upgrade on some of your airports. You could use an upgrades on some of your roads, et cetera. And, you know, we can debate whether that'd be productive investment or not, et cetera. But here's what I know for sure. Spending $4.5 trillion to pay people to watch TV or play video games, that money will never be reimbursed. That will never be a productive investment. And so as we look at, you know, those $1,000 checks, $2,000 checks, it's basically the drawing up of some kind of universal basic income scheme. You have to acknowledge that the investment environment has changed dramatically. The world that we now live in is completely different than the one that we've lived in up until a year ago. And, you know, for me, the biggest victim out of all of this is fixed income in developed markets. You can't have this kind of increase in debt and either not end up with a crisis on bonds or a crisis on your currency. You're going to get one or the other, perhaps both. To me, you know, if you look at the amount, you know, I think there's around $18 trillion of negative yielding debt around the world today. It's this 18 trillion means that if you compound that over time, it either means that this capital is going to be destroyed, is basically worthless since it's a negative yield. It's this worthless capital. Option one, or option two, the currency that it's denominated in are going to become worthless. So that's, you know, have you made the adjustments in your portfolio to that new reality? And if you haven't, then you should.
Mm-hmm. Great. And your final thoughts, Ira?
Yeah. And so let me pick up. This is a great line earlier, rising yields, falling currencies. That is the worst rung to be on. And I know that, Larry Summers has been out, talking about that Yellen should talk about a strong dollar. Let me say something. That's, because Summers talked about when Bob Rubin, when he was there as in the 90s, and Rubin was the Secretary of Treasury, and it was always a strong dollar. Well, let me tell you, let's call that BS, because Bob Rubin had talked about a strong dollar, but let's go back to June of 1998, Clinton's famous trip to China, in which he did not visit Japan and the Japanese viewed it with great insult. But prior to the onset of that trip, what does the U.S. do? The U.S. intervenes to weaken the dollar by buying yen, because the Chinese were very upset. The weekend, I think the yen was up to 135 area to the dollar. I could look at, I'm not going on the screen. But don't just talk about a strong dollar, because the dollar plays a phenomenal role in many aspects, especially when you've been to reserve currency. So I think I just say Lewis's comment, rising yields, falling currency, is an equation and a formula to watch to see how this reacts. And he's 100% right. And this is why I continue being bearish the dollar the last quarter when people were still pushing the haven status, because even when yields were starting to tickle up, the dollar could not get any traction. And that was with Europe doing everything they can to talk down the euro, and not just talking. They're not just jawboning. They're also busy. They're the ultimate yield curve players. They don't admit it because they do it via sovereigns. So by pushing down yields on Italian 10 years, Portuguese 10 years, Spanish 10 years, it's the same thing as yield curve control. They just don't have a euro bond to do it with. But that's in essence what they're doing, because as you push down Italian yields, you push down all the yields. So it plays the same role. So these are all things that are in motion. And the Japanese, we don't know how much the Japanese really do now. We don't know, because they own so much of the Japanese bond market. But there is another static analysis that arises. People say, oh, the U.S. is going to be like Japan. No, they're not. There's nothing similar. When the Japanese 10 years dropped to 20 to 30 basis points, the yen kept rallying because Japan was in actual deflation. So you had a real yield on Japanese bonds, on Japanese JGBs. So, and 97% of them were domestically owned. The United States situation is so vastly different. And then, I kind of laugh when people go, oh, we're not. We're nothing like them. The United States has never had deflation. This whole time, we've just been operating in real negative yields. Now, I would argue that the 30-year in the U.S. is probably the best buy, because it's the only thing that has a zero real yield. So why would I buy a 5-year yielding, 50 basis points? Inflation is, by the latest measures anticipated to be the magic 2% bullet. So there are just, and these are going to drive all types of investments. And I think that line about rising yields and falling currency, you better pay attention to it. And listen, watch what happens in China. China's very comfortable with this, but I think that, and again, picking up on Michael Pettis, I think China is ramping up. When I say ramping up, you know, their domestic consumption as a percent of GDP is so low, they have room. They could grow that 10, 12, 14%. But if you're going to grow your domestic consumption as a part, as a larger part of your GDP rather than exporting, you want a stronger currency because you want to enrich your middle class who's going to spend more. So this makes a lot of sense. There are a lot of things in motion. And you know what? I would ask this, Richard, that Luce and I get a chance to come back in 3, 4, 5 months to take a look to see what that looks like. And I will be following Yavkel very closely, and I advise a lot of people to do the same thing.
Oh, great. It's been a very interesting discussion, very insightful. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Luis?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me. Always great to catch up with you and Ira. And I was delighted to do this. The best thing is probably to go to our website. I don't really have a social media presence. We have different offerings for different types of investors, on our website, which is gafcal.com. That's, Golf Alpha Victor Echo Kilo Alpha Lima.com, gafcal.com. Sign up for whatever you may be interested in.
Great. And Ira?
I'm still, I'm back to blogging more frequently. I haven't written, maybe I'll get one out tonight with the unemployment number tomorrow, because my community, as much as they invest in our trading community, and are as dynamic as anybody, because, you know, the static nature of it, again, I warn against it. When I lecture in college classes, as I've done many times over the past, be dynamic. Be not only in your thinking, but in your actions. Now, you will make mistakes, but okay. But if you protect your capital while you're making mistakes, you're in the best of all world, because you will find your way to high quality investments. And I don't know how Gavcal performed last year. I don't know what their final numbers were, but I can imagine that they did pretty well. Their two recent pieces have been really phenomenal and gotten a lot of read. But I'm still at Notes from Underground, the Financial Repression Authority podcast, and a few other places, but not doing any of the mass media. And I don't myself, I'm kind of loose on the social media. I don't tweet really myself, but others do it to get it out there, which I don't mind, as long as it stays at a high level of discussion. And as I say, discourse. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Luis and Ira.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.